So now we get to enjoy the expertise of the other distinguished gentlemen on this panel a little more fully, and I appreciate your patience during our enriching discussion with Senator Leahy. There's so much to talk about. I promise to keep my questions brief, and I hope you will get kind of punchy and quick on your answers so we can get a lot in. Jonathan, I'd like to return to you. You've recently written an article, I think it was recent, in which you article's title is "Reporting is Not a Crime," which I think is a relief to a lot of us in this room who've been wondering lately. But on a more serious note, you have said that you support prosecution, I think, of government employees who divulge classified information. This legislation by Kit Bond, known by its detractors as the Official Secrets Act, would impose this blanket criminal penalty for the first time, and we certainly do need to talk about the balance between national security and the right to know, but tell us what you think of this act, and how do you draw the line on what's considered classified versus what should be made available?
The article, "Reporting is Not a Crime," there were, for people that are interested, I did two articles for National Review Online and one for the American Bar Association's National Security Newsletter on this whole question of whether or not journalists can be prosecuted for publishing classified information. As I'm sure all of you are aware, some members of the administration have suggested that that it is possible to prosecute journalists for that, and there are laws in the books, in particular the Espionage Act, which, if given a sufficiently expansive reading, would seem to support that. And these articles were arguing that that is the wrong way to go about trying to keep classified information classified. One of the things I did also, though, say in that article is that if the government is trying to keep the lid on classified information, where it should focus are those who are on those who are given security clearances, who are hired by the government or otherwise given access to certain information, and that the government should focus on those individuals and should be more aggressive in dealing with leakers than in with those members of the public, whether they be journalists, bloggers, or as we see in a current case that's pending in the Eastern District of Virginia, or sorry, in the District of Columbia, employees of public interest organizations, as some of you may know, two former employees of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee are currently being prosecuted for conspiring to violate the Espionage Act for actions that I'm sure many of you engage in every day, that is identifying individuals in government agencies who have information that they're not supposed to tell you and taking them to lunch or maybe going to a baseball game or having coffee with them and hoping that they'll tell you something that they shouldn't have told you. And for doing this, these two individuals are being prosecuted. And one of the articles I wrote focuses on why this is hopefully unconstitutional, but even if it's not unconstitutional, horrific public policy. In terms of the bond bill, I warned folks that I was not going to give a full-throated defense of the bond bill. I do think, as I said, that the Justice Department should focus more on leakers than those who receive leaked information. But my concerns with the bond bill would be that it doesn't seem to offer enough of an affirmative defense. On the one hand, if, take an extreme example, there is, an individual who has access to top secret national defense information gives it to someone who's not authorized to have information. I think it's reasonable to say that that person should be able to be prosecuted for doing so. But if that person, for example, discloses information that stands classified that's really about a sweetheart contract that went to someone that's rebuilding Iraq or whatever else, I think all of us would be concerned about that. I think the way to deal with that is through things like whistleblower statutes and the like, some of which, as some of you may know, the federal whistleblower provisions in the environmental context under current law are not always applicable to state governments, even though they're supposed to be. There have been court cases refusing to apply them. But that if someone enters into a relationship with the government where they agree to work with classified information and agree to keep that information secret, I don't have a problem with the government holding them to that bargain. I think what our focus should be on is trying to make sure the government's policies about what is or is not classified are the right policies, and I'm not sure this administration has done struck the right balance there. And on ensuring that whistleblowers receive adequate protection, which may mean requiring whistleblowers to do something other than go to the press, right? It might mean that they go to an ombudsman or they go to an inspector general or they go to a congressional committee. But I think that's the way you deal with improper classification.
Speaking of whistleblowing, Jim Hansen, you really have been a whistleblower. I was going to raise the article you did. What about these cuts and the change in wording that takes out understanding and protecting our home planet? Is this going, how much will this hamper federal research on climate change? And are there areas being cut, even that the administration itself says we need additional research in? Expand on your concerns about that.
Oh, it will have a huge impact. Because, you know, we're getting missions that begin to tell us very interesting things, like the gravity satellite, which shows the mass of Greenland is decreasing. And
can you all hear? Do you need to hold the mic?
There is very little money for any new missions. I mean, the NASA Earth Science budget has been declining now for several years. And well, now they finally reinstituted an advisory committee, and I'm on that committee. But you know, what fun is it to advise when you're only talking about missions that might begin to spend money on 6 years from now? And that's very hypothetical. So that you're just doing busy work. And it's non-negligible. It's a very serious cut, and it's going to have impact on our ability to know what's going on with the planet.
How tough is it to have done what you've done? Has your life become a lot more difficult since you've blown the whistle?
It's become harder to do research just because of the media people.
Time-consuming, you mean?
So I have to ration the amount of time I spend talking to media. But in terms of impact of the government on me. Now they know that they're better off not putting any restrictions on me, because as soon as there is a restriction, I'll tell the media about it.
A felicitous situation. I wonder, Dickhoff, if you could talk with us some. You are very well aware, I'm sure, of what many people in this room experienced, certainly after 9/11, but especially after Katrina, people trying to figure out what was in the water in New Orleans. What can people in this room do to get information that clearly seems to be important information to put in the hands of the public? What are some of the ways around, you know, these amazing redactions and fees, and what's your advice?
I think first thing is, one of the points that was made during the session yesterday is make Freedom of Information Act requests and make them often and make them sophisticatedly. Don't say, give me all information about pollution as a result of Katrina. You know, that's like the one the Army got 30 years ago, saying, please give me everything about the Vietnam War. That's too broad, and narrow it down. One of the things that, and I'm going to have an opportunity Wednesday morning to speak to the EPA FOIA processors. They have an annual training conference, and at that time I will chat with them about some of the concerns that you raised. But one of the requests specifically that they got, that an individual from EPA told me on Katrina's, is literally 3 days after Katrina got there, what data do you have from New Orleans about the problems of Katrina? And what sorts of, it was more sophisticated than I'm saying it right now. And the answer is, we don't have people in New Orleans. We've taken them all out, just like everybody else. And there were some of that which I think was a bit of a problem. So you're going to have to give them a little bit of slack on something like that. Now that that's done, we're certainly well beyond where they're able to use any defense like that. But EPA during this past year had fewer requests made to it. I think that's an indictment of your agency, of your organization, that there were fewer. It went from 14,000 down to 12,000. Somebody's not doing their business out there. Now, maybe the response to that is, Dick, we've had to wait too long on too many requests, and it's just not worth the postage. That is something sad. The next thing I would want to say is, when you do get a denial from EPA or Justice or any other agency, if it doesn't make sense, if it doesn't seem like it's the right thing at all, by all means, file an appeal. That costs you another stamp or a fax straight into the to the appeal agency. And if there's a denial, they're supposed to give you the address of the appeal agency. I don't want to say that the FBI and DEA and the Antitrust Division got reversed all the time, but at the Department of Justice, about 20 to 25% over the last 2 years or so of all denials that I received an appeal on up until October of last year, more information went out. Sometimes it was just a little bit more. Sometimes it was another 150 pages. So it can vary in terms of something like that. But by all means, exercise that right. And then the last right that you certainly have, and that at the federal level you certainly want to consider, is after the time period runs, whether that's under the federal system, it's 20 working days, which the agency can extend by another 10 days if it's a voluminous request, if they have to consult with another agency, or if they have to go to another office to look for records. But thinking of that, either 20 or 30 working days, if the agency hasn't responded at that time, bring a lawsuit. And you can say, wait a minute, I'm a lawyer, I'm a journalist, I'm not a lawyer, I'm not going to end up doing that. There are a lot, as many of you know, there are a lot of public interest groups, and in fact, there was a gentleman I had dinner with last night who I'm sure handles many of these for free, and he would stand up right now if he wants me to identify him. Patrick, thank you. And if you've got a law school in your area, by all means, there's usually an administrative law clinic, or frequently an administrative law clinic, that will help you bring a lawsuit like that. And that helps move an agency forward. My own parochial view is I think that EPA is one that can easily be helped along with a lawsuit, just to get it going. And I don't mean broadly. I mean, if you've been 20 or 30 days, by all means, before you rock it in the lawsuit, use the telephone. And how long does it look like this so you don't file a lawsuit and get the papers 3 days later? But by all means, go ahead, give a phone call. Use that tracking system that the new executive order says you've got. Call a person up there and say, listen, this is a problem. I'm on deadline. I've already asked for expedited processing to start with. Here we're sitting and it's been a month. When am I going to get an answer? And, I'm not sure. We've got a backlog. We don't have enough people. That's the sort of thing where maybe you can consider bringing a lawsuit.
One more question.
That's harsh, saying that against federal agencies, but that sometimes does get attention. That moves the paper faster.
One more question I've been dying to ask you ever since I met you is about the famous Ashcroft memo,
sure,
which was born before 9/11. You all know it, essentially urging that we err on the side of non-disclosure, urging FOIA officials at various agencies. So, I mean, this affects so much more than Homeland Security. What's the story about it? What was your role in it? What will you tell us about it?
Well, I can tell you that I found it interesting to read what our program was going to be about with regard to FOIA, that Ashcroft ordered federal agencies to err on the side of secrecy, and that with America under attack, Ashcroft argued the country must keep critical information out of the hands of the enemies. That isn't what the Ashcroft memo said. I mean, it's not what the Ashcroft memo said. It's on the Department of Justice website. You can hit www.usdoj.gov, hit the FOIA button, hit resource materials, and there it is. And it doesn't say that at all. It talks about discretionary disclosure, and it doesn't talk about anything else. And it does say, be more careful on discretionary disclosure. And that's essentially what a one-page memo ends up saying. It says also, agencies, we're not going to second-guess you if you do refuse to exercise your discretion. We're going to go ahead and defend you if you've got a reasonable basis in law for defending the FOIA action, which is the same standard that we would use under the Federal Tort Claims Act. I'm still saying this, we would. I am not in the Department of Justice. I need to remind myself and the camera of that. The same standard that department would have used and still does use, to the best of my knowledge, to defend cases of that sort. But the Ashcroft memo, although it is dated October 12th, I was familiar with drafts on it and working, had a part in the drafting of the memo for Attorney General Ashcroft. It was ready. It went to his office in very early September. Had September 11th not come about, it probably would have been the September 15th or September 20th memo. And it was only because of 9/11 that it got pushed back till October 12th. It wasn't. There were two changes made, and they were essentially moreover to furthermore in terms of two very small, two word changes that were made. It wasn't changed as a result of 9/11. And you can say, wait, it was here came 9/11, here came the memo. There must be a cause and effect. No, there wasn't. That memo was in the works for 3 months, 2 months before it was ultimately promulgated.
Jonathan, I want to get back to your very real concerns when we see tragedies like 9/11, or before that, of course, the Bhopal Indian tragedy, which silently killed probably more than died in the World Trade Center. It is clear we need to worry about putting information in the hands of terrorists. But how do citizens and communities surrounding dangerous chemical facilities, say, who need to know the extent of damage possible, you know, get access to risk management plans? What are your thoughts about how this difficult balance ought to be achieved?
Well, I think there's when we talk about community right to know, we have to ask who are we talking about has a right to know, and what is it that they have a right to get information about? And in the context of, for example, the Clean Air Act provisions that required facilities using particular chemicals to develop risk management plans and worst case scenarios, I was among those that suggested that putting this information on the web in a searchable database probably wasn't the smartest thing, or if it seemed like a good idea prior to 9/11, after 9/11 probably wasn't a good idea, particularly once we learned that at least one of the 9/11 hijackers had investigated chemical facilities and as possible targets, or at least it appears that one of them did. My own view is that the who, when we're talking about an individual facility, is the local community. I mean, I certainly think that local communities should demand information about local facilities, should require the disclosure of information as part of the zoning or permitting process, should make sure that information is available to first responders and the like. I mean, the idea that, for example, fire departments would not know what chemicals are in what facilities, I mean, that would just be nuts not to provide that information. But I don't think that necessarily, again, means that putting this information on a searchable internet database, where at least at one point in time you could put in, you know, I forget when I wrote these articles what my search terms were, but, you know, things like school, thousand, and, you know, explosion, and, you know, you and estate, and you could find out, okay, which facilities could be blown up to cause fatalities in the thousands. My view is that, you know, the government shouldn't, I don't think the government should classify that information. I don't think it should pull it out of libraries. But I think it's reasonable to say that the government doesn't need to make that information so readily available that anyone can access it without it being possible to know who's looking for that information and accessing it. And that isn't censoring that information, but it's recognizing that it's one thing to say that a local community should know about what's involved with a facility. It's another thing to say that we should make it easy for people that might want to do bad things to do those bad things.
Yes, I was just going to say, so many good panelists, so little time. I've definitely underutilized Joe. While we prepare for people to come to the microphones to ask questions during a final half hour, Joe, I bet you have not only a comment, but maybe a question or two for the fellow panelists.
I have a comment. John's so reasonable, it's hard to disagree with him. I think that...
Jonathan, please be more unreasonable so we can disagree.
Certainly there are legitimate concerns about chemical security information and not getting the wrong information into the wrong hands. But if you look at the practical effect of this, the public has a lot of stake in getting that information. The people at Bhopal were essentially killed by lack of information. They didn't know what the gas was when people were walking into the emergency rooms. The the effect of 5, 6, 7 years of secrecy about chemical security and safety in this country has essentially been to give Congress and the industry at least a 5-year delay in the enactment of any effective chemical security legislation at all. There was one just passed this recent year, and it's a very weak one by some people's standards. But the effect of this lack of information, it's not just about, it's not just the local people that need it, it's the national media that need it. And, you know, if the plants that are the most dangerous in this country are already well known to the nonprofit sector, the media, and the terrorists, it's not a secret. And as John practically admits, well, they knew about all this stuff 5 years ago, the terrorists did, so it's not lack of information that's keeping us safe. And what it has done, though, it has prevented politically any pressure to be generated behind stronger chemical security legislation. So I think it's a little bit misleading. I think it would be good for the public to know which companies were threatening the lives of the most people with their chemical plants.
I promise each of you a minute at the end to make a final point, but let's go now to the floor for questions. Remember, journalists first, and please identify yourselves.
We'll start.
Over here on the right.
Okay, this is working. Good. Okay. My name is Mark Schlesstein. I'm a reporter with the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, and I'm the guy who filed the FOI request with EPA immediately after the storm. And what the request specifically asked for was what companies had reported whatever threats to EPA on the day of the storm and the day after the storm, and what was EPA's response. It was a question that I had asked of EPA officials for 4 days before filing the request. The response that I eventually got more than a month later was, go look at the National Response Council's website where everything is listed. When I went there, what I found was a month later, the individual reports of the companies, what they had reported, were there. What was not there was EPA's response. It is now October 29th, and I still have not gotten a response from EPA. And the reason we were interested in that information, I want to say in New Orleans, but unfortunately, 4 days afterwards, I was in Baton Rouge because New Orleans was flooded. We were trying to get information about specific threats to residents who were still in the city. And we had no way of explaining what releases had been reported by industry because no one was giving us the information. So how do we as reporters get this information in a timely fashion, in a way that our residents, the people who read our newspapers and watch our TV stations, can use that information to make decisions about whether they should evacuate, how they should evacuate, and where they should evacuate.
Dick, you want to start?
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
I think the answer to how you're going to be able to do that in a storm like that is EPA isn't there. That was my understanding. Now maybe I'm incorrect. Maybe
reports made to the national office,
and it right away. I suspect that I don't know the answer to your question. I suspect that the national office was awfully busy with other topics at that time, and they should have been getting that not just to the Times-Picayune, but as broadly as they possibly could, through press releases, through announcements, through, and I regret to say that, through FEMA, whoever it is, through the Department of Homeland Security, to say, here are the problems in these areas. And I think, as you were painfully aware, far more than I am, the federal government was unable to do that at all during that time.
Can I just add, EPA wasn't too busy to issue press statements on its national website saying, well, we have been collecting this information, and here's some of the broad outlines of it. So they were bragging about how they were on top of the situation, and they had the information, which is why Mark asked for it. And EPA was as much there as anyone. In fact, the early stories were that they were so busy pulling people out of the water that they couldn't do their sampling program. So they were on site, and they were trying to measure this stuff. And they did have a kind of national incident response command center for this set up very quickly. I can't tell you exactly what day. So they used a whole series of other subterfuges to prevent this information coming out. And they were quick to admit, well, yeah, we do have some sampling information, but we're not going to give it to you because we have to put it through Data Quality Act controls. When, in fact, these were standard lab protocols. There's no reason to go through separate Data Quality Act checks for bacteria counts and chemical analyses because they're done with standard lab protocols. And these aren't exemptions of FOIA. So the panoply of reasons that EPA gave don't really seem to wash. And I think there's an alternative hypothesis that explains the data, and that's that EPA didn't want people to know how bad it was because they would get upset.
Okay, we'll go to this side of the room. Please identify yourself.
Tom Muelsman, Center for Environmental Journalism. This is a question for James Hansen. We know from the video in Inconvenient Truth that previous administrations have tried to control scientific information. You were testifying at a congressional hearing at that time and giving answers about how that happened back, I think it was in the first Bush administration. So my question is, to what degree is the attempt to control scientific administration for political reasons qualitatively or quantitatively different now? Is it different, and if so, how much so?
Yeah. As has been mentioned several times, the problems with the information flow did not originate with this administration. And I've had difficulties with prior administrations, including Democratic administrations. For example, if you submit a paper which to the, you know, each agency has a public affairs office, and if you want your scientific results to become available to the public, you have to go through the public affairs office. If you submit a paper now which says that, oh, I've discovered that the ocean doesn't take up carbon dioxide as effectively as we had thought it did, then in the present administration, you know, that report will end up in a wastebasket. But that sort of thing happened with prior administrations. There's apparently a feeling that they have the right to influence what gets out to the public rather than simply let it be based on scientific results. But it's become qualitatively different, and it's worse situation now than with prior administrations. For example, it got to the extent of having a dry run of press conference, and I would not submit to such a thing, but one of my colleagues went to one. It was to be a press conference on Arctic sea ice and the fact that it's decreasing quite rapidly. And a trial question was, well, what can we do about this? Is there anything we can do about this? And my colleague said, well, we could reduce the rate of emission of greenhouse gases. The guy jumped up and said, that's unacceptable. So, because this relates to policy, and a scientist is not allowed to say anything about policy. Well, anyway, and when I when I gave a talk at last year at the AGU meeting, and it got a lot of attention, which surprised the public affairs officers at NASA headquarters, I was told that from then on, any time the media contacted me, I had to first inform the public affairs office. I could not speak to the media until I had informed them, and gave NASA headquarters the right of first refusal. If they thought that it's a sensitive question and they would prefer that I not answer it, then they're allowed to answer for me. And also they demanded that I give them my schedule every, you know, so at that point, that's when I decided I was going to make this public. And now I don't have that problem. And the NASA administrator came forward and made a very strong, clear statement that scientists should be allowed to communicate with the public. But the paper on which the actual statement, if you look at the new rules, they're really very ambiguous. And in NASA, I think we feel comfortable that we're just going to take the NASA administrator at his word at face value. But in fact, the Government Accountability Project, in looking at these new rules, sees there's a lot of problems with these, and they can still use these new rules to squelch what you want to say. And it depends upon the quality of the person in charge. And at present, we have a good administrator in NASA, but that's not necessarily true in other agencies.
Thank you. Over here.
Hi, my name is John Daly. I'm a reporter with KSL Television in Salt Lake City. I have another question for Jim, although the rest of you are welcome to chime in on this as well. It kind of falls along that. You may have just answered this, but do you understand why did they try to silence you regarding climate change? Was it hostility to science in general? Was it protection of certain industries? Do you understand? Did anyone ever explain why? Or why do you think they were trying to keep a lid on this? Because obviously it kind of backfired.
Well, I think it's clear that, you know, well, first of all, my AGU talk, I connected the dots all the way from the emissions up to the impacts and implications about things that we had better start doing if we're going to avoid dramatic, undesirable changes downstream. And there's simply not agreement in this administration that we should do the things that need to get done. And therefore, because it has policy implications and they don't like those policy implications, they'd prefer that we not talk about it.
Over here on this side.
Yeah, I'm Nancy. Oops. I'm Nancy Basilchuk. I'm a freelance writer and conference chair. This is a question also for Dr. Hansen. You, and again, it relates. It's a follow-on what you've just been talking about. I'm curious. I have a two-part question. The first part is, have you any sense? You spoke up, but I have to. Oops, Dale cut me off. have you any sense of other agencies where this is particularly a problem, where folks are being censored in any way and perhaps maybe don't feel as able to come forward as you did? I mean, do you have any suggestions for us as reporters to go looking for potential whistleblowers who maybe have less of an ability to step forward as you did?
Well, yeah, I already had made a comment in a talk at the New School University that I felt the situation was even worse in EPA and NOAA. And, you know, of course, you have to be aware that probably 99 point something percent of the scientists are doing technical things which are not going to be of concern and are not going to be limited or censored because they don't cause any impact on policy. directly. So I was a little worried that when, after I made that statement, but as it turned out, there were some scientists that came forward and mentioned that they had had experiences comparable to mine in those agencies. And since that time, I was also told by some people in the National Institute of Health that they were very constrained in what they were allowed to say in areas that you can imagine. So I think EPA has, for a long time, has had problems in that they've lost many good scientists just because of those constraints. They don't want to work for an agency in which it's so strong, the information flow is so strongly controlled by the administration.
Back over here, Robert.
Robert McClure from the Seattle PI. This is a question for Dick Huff. This is a further follow-up to the Katrina question, Dick. I don't know if Mark did this in his request, but after we found out he was having trouble, a bunch of SEJers, including my colleague Lisa Stifler on our behalf, filed FOIA requests. And I don't think Mark used the... Oh, I'm sorry. Can you all hear me now? Okay. The question's about... It follows on the Katrina... when we found out that Mark Schlifstein was having the trouble getting that information, a bunch of us filed our own FOIA requests, and I don't think Mark did this, but we cited the expedited review provisions of FOIA, which say that that they have to move quickly and get us the information when, quote, delayed disclosure could threaten the life or personal safety, end quote, of citizens. So. I mean, this, I can't think of a better example of when expedited review should have been invoked. And as far as I know, the FOIA that Lisa filed, we still haven't gotten a response. So what are we to do? I mean, it seems to me that makes a mockery of that provision.
The only thing I can think of is just the steps the statute provides is file an appeal if they did not respond within 10 days, and they didn't. They have just 10 days to make the, as you know, to make a determination as to whether they will or won't move you to the front of the line. And if they haven't done that, you can file an appeal. The statute is ambiguous, but the case law has said you may file an appeal, but you may go directly to court after 10 days if you have asked for expedited processing and the agency hasn't responded. Not if they said no, but if they haven't responded, you can go into court at that time. Again, before you do that, make a phone call and see if there's anything that you can get out of, you know, start with the national office or whatever regional office that you sent your request to. And sometimes there may be something that they could say, my God, we lost that, we're going to find it, we're going to do something, or it will give you the kind of information where you say, okay, I'm either going to have to do nothing or I'm and just wait, or I'm going to have to file a lawsuit.
We have one last question at each mic, so over here, and then we'll go to the panel for final word.
Hi, I'm Jim Bruggers. I'm a reporter with the Courier-Journal in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm an SEJ board member. And I first want to issue a challenge to all the journalists in the room here to please cover secrecy and open government issues in your publications and television stations and radio stations and websites. And I have a question for Geneva, please. How do we pitch these stories to editors? Sometimes it's seen as inside baseball, people complaining about, reporters complaining about having a hard time getting the information they need.
Well, as a one-time Freedom of Information Committee chair at the American Society of Newspaper Editors, I do think we've been in a lull about really standing up for these issues. I think that's changing. I should say that now, at the risk of sounding in-house, my husband is now the chair of the Freedom of Information Committee at AS&E. And I believe that AS&E is getting back into this very powerfully. A lot of people are. Tom Curley, who is the Associated Press CEO, as you know, has spoken out on behalf. There is an enormous coalition now, Sunshine in Government, which is very active in Washington. I'd like to plug my own colleague, Charles Davis, of the National Freedom of Information Coalition at the Missouri School of Journalism. I couldn't agree with you more. We should do a much better job, and I started to say amen before you directed the question to me, so I'm glad to be able to get up on my soapbox and talk about this, and I think that editors are much more likely to understand now that they need to be doing this. If they're not, and you have an eloquent case to make just based on the kind of information you're no longer able to get, that citizens in your community very much want and need to have. So I hope all of you will become as avid as you can be about this, and I assume this panel will help. So, Andy, you get the last question. I'm sorry, we're going to have to cut it off after that, and then the panelists get to speak.
Andy Revkin, New York Times. This is for Jim and the others, I guess. Some people have been rather grumpy about this idea that NASA put forward after the revelations this year, that it is possible for a scientist who works for the government, who works for the administration, to put his coat on the wall and speak as an individual on policy, not just science. And some people have said, you know, administration basically has the right to pick and choose facts to suit its agenda, just as the partisans we were talking about with last night do. And some have said that, Jim, you should, if you're getting more toward feeling it's imperative to speak on policy, you should essentially, you know, step down from NASA and move over to Columbia full time or to Princeton or something. This is a question mainly for Adler and Mr. Hupp. Does an administration have the right to speak with one voice, have its administration speak with one voice on policy?
Does it or should it?
I'll leave that up to you.
Does it or should it?
Should it? Well, does it under the law? Is there any reason they can't clamp down and say, unlike what Griffin did in February, you don't have the right to speak? You're an employee of me, and especially someone like Jim, who's not a career person, but who's a, whatever you call it, senior executive service. You have to, you know, play by my rules, or you can leave.
In terms of can it, the question is it depends. There's a case that from the Supreme Court last term, which if you aren't familiar with, you should be, even though it has nothing to do with the environment, called Garcetti versus Ceballos, which involved the issue of can a government employee have First Amendment protection for speech that occurred in the course of that employee's work for the government? And this involved a prosecutor in Los Angeles who believed that the police in a case had done something wrong, and this came out in a case, and he was assigned what's called freeway duty, which is you're assigned to the farthest, you know, most remote office, so you spend, you know, most of your time in your car driving to and from work on the Los Angeles freeway, and it's understood that that's what gets done to people that the higher-ups don't like. And the Supreme Court said that if it's speech that occurs within the context of your work, it doesn't have First Amendment protection, and it's a pure policy question about whether or not it can receive whistleblower protection or not. And it's an issue for legislatures to decide. Had it been speech outside of the performance of one's job duties, it would have received a certain amount of First Amendment protection. So instead of saying, you know, in a memo to his boss, "I think this cop is lying," which is more or less what happened, you know, on Saturday, this Ceballos had gone to a rally, you know, saying that there needed to be, you know, I don't know, you know, greater or, you know, bigger budget for the police department or smaller budget for the police department or whatever else, presumably that would have been protected. But it is a careful dance, and the reality is there are lots of ways that government officials can, as I'm sure Jim could probably explain better than I, can take negative adverse actions against people who work in the government without actually having to clamp down on them. And there are lots of examples of that, something that I'm familiar with over the last 15 years. I don't think that's a good thing. I do think at some point one has to recognize that if one works for the government, that does impose certain limitations that working somewhere else might not. And I will admit that being a tenured academic, that's very easy for me to say. Because I'm in a very lucky or fortunate position in that regard, but you know that is a reality, and there are scientists, and you know, one in the climate context that comes to mind is Roy Spencer, who is, shall we say, a lot more outspoken about his personal beliefs on climate now that he works for the University of Alabama than when he was an employee of NASA.
All right, now I'm going to ask each of our panelists to give us one final word of wisdom. And if you're not inspired by any given topic, then address the difficult question of, you know, that we're in a war of terrorism, not likely to go away anytime soon. How do you balance the need for government controls on information and the public's need and right to know? But we'll start with you, Dick Huff, and go down the road.
I'd like to start, and I'm sorry that Senator Leahy is no longer here, but I want to just finish up on one point with regard to his legislation. His legislation has 13 subparts or 13 sections, 10 of which have substantive impact, one of which I think is an extremely worrisome provision, and that if I were to make a decision on it, I would delete that one provision. I'm not positive I have a good reason or a good basis to offer another suggestion, but his provision says that his and Senator Leahy's or Senator Cornyn's in 628 says that if the agency does not respond within the time limits, 20 days or 30 days, then the agency is not able to assert any exemptions except for the first exemption dealing with national security, information that is protected under the Privacy Act or proprietary data, or information that is otherwise protected by another statute, such as grand jury information or income tax information. Other than that, if the requester brings a lawsuit, the court may require the agency to disclose all of that and can waive that provision only by clear and convincing evidence that there was good cause for the failure to comply with the time limits. I think it's going to be difficult to show clear and convincing evidence good cause for failure to comply with the time limits. Maybe EPA could for the first few days if there were a request for a Katrina information directed to a Katrina office in New Orleans. But beyond that, I think that's a very high standard. What that means is we'll still be able to protect national security information even if we have a long backlog. We don't have enough employees to process all of the requests. We have a long backlog. That's probably not going to be a good cause. Information that's going to be disclosed will be personal privacy information, such as information about foreigners. We've had information the Supreme Court has protected under the sixth exemption dealing with personal privacy about Haitians that were sent back after they had boat people that were sent back. Department of State interviewed them to see whether or not they had been discriminated against or treated wrongfully by their nation when they were sent back. That information, the Supreme Court said, can be protected. The identities of those people, not what they, not the information that they gave, but their identities. That wouldn't be so under the new legislation. Furthermore, something that Department of Justice does in health care fraud cases is the department will go out and get a search warrant and bring a doctor's or other health care provider's medical records in. And we might bring in 1,000 different medical records showing that everybody received far more tests than was medically necessary. That would be an example where all of that information would be given out to you and to everybody else who made the request. This is also something where it would be made where the Department of Justice is going after a polluter and is about to prosecute them. If the polluter asks for it and we don't respond timely, the polluter can get it as well.
Jim Henson, a one-minute nugget, please.
Oh, just one?
Yeah.
There was some confusion on my part.
That's all right.
Well, since I've come here to talk with environmental journalists, I would like to say one thing. You know, there's a huge gap between what is understood about global warming and what is known about global warming. And by that I mean what is understood by the relevant scientific community and what is known by the people who need to know, and that's the public and the policymakers. I think the public is unaware of the fact that how close we are to a tipping point and how close we are to pushing the climate into a regime that it has not been in millions of years. And that's not speculation. It's, the science is clear. They're unaware of how much we know about the consequences if we do that. And they're unaware of the fact that the actions that we would need to take in order to avert that have enormous collateral benefits in terms of energy independence and in terms of improved atmosphere for reduced air pollution and the impacts of that on human health and on the impact on our industries and our competitiveness with the rest of the world. And so the question is, why is that? And I think that it's partly because of the effectiveness of the special interests and the politicians supported by special interests who, for, and there's just two things I want to mention. They insist on balance, and that means putting up a bumbling scientist who always has to be balanced by an articulate lawyer who has a degree in science but in fact is not acting as a scientist, but he's just pointing out all of the things he can think of that support a particular perspective. And the second point is the swift boating, which we talked about a little bit yesterday, and Mark Morano, for example, would insist that you have to include this statement that I had a $250,000 grant from a Democrat. And, you know, and they're extremely effective at this. They hammer this because they sound so reasonable, and they just keep hammering on these points. You've got to have balance. And that sounds reasonable. You should have balance. And you should disclose. But, you know, they do this so effectively, and in the process they're making it very difficult to communicate with the public and things which we really should be communicating with the public.
Joe, you get 45 seconds and have sympathy on Jonathan.
45 seconds. I'm tired of feeling powerless and helpless. I think that environmental journalists already have in their hands most of the powers and tools they need to do good stories. The most important is to cover things. If secrecy is a problem, cover it. FOIA's, for all its imperfections, is a powerful tool. Use it. And when FOIA doesn't work and disclosure isn't happening, do the old-fashioned reporting. Get leaks, get sources, make inferences, dig up court discovery stuff. And I think the final thing is that secrecy doesn't sell well to editors sometimes because it is an inside baseball story. So the biggest challenge, and that's all on us, not on anyone else, is make it matter to your readers. And it does.
Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo, I think, everything Joe just said. I think in thinking about these issues, it's very easy to celebrate the need for open government. I certainly believe in that. I certainly believe there's too much secrecy. But I think, you know, most of this room, you know, who are journalists or academics or whatever, and part of the reason we do what we do is because information is powerful. But that means it's powerful for both good and for ill, and that information that can produce power, good changes, in some cases information can be used to produce bad changes. And so as a result, we have a situation, we live in a world where there will have to be some secrets, there will have to be some classified information. And the government will either, for political reasons or other reasons, is going to make mistakes and is going to have a natural tendency to err on the side of keeping more secrets than necessary. And that makes being diligent and pushing the government on that very, very important. But it's not something that is confined to this era or this administration. It's something we've seen in the national security context going back decades and decades. You know, back to the days when overseas mail was all opened and read by the federal government. So. It's just important to remember that there is this careful balance that needs to be struck, and that we can usually be sure that the government is not striking the right balance.
Panelists, I thank you warmly, and I ask the audience to join me.